Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, June 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman has returned to the show to address your puzzling astronomy conundrums. Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. He has been featured in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine, and he's the astronomy editor of Old Farmer's Almanac. Do you have a question about the Milky Way, black holes, or Saturn's rings? If so, or anything else for that matter, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Always fun and informative to have Bob Berman on the program. He is here today, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Renowned astronomer Bob Berman is back in Studio A to answer all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob's forthcoming book is called Cataclysm, and he's written many other books, and he translates complex scientific concepts into terms that even I can understand. And there are a lot of things happening up in the heavens, and we'll get to those today and your calls at 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
So, Mars Opportunity Rover is going dark.
Yeah, a little bit of a problem. It happens from time to time. Mars gets these periodic dust storms. You can see it for yourself with a good enough telescope. Mars is going to be just the brightest thing in the sky in July and August. So that's coming up.
Right.
And it's already quite bright in the morning sky. But if you look at it through a telescope, all the detail has gone away. It's turned into just a yellow blob without any of the usual blotchy surface detail because there's a global dust storm sweeping over the planet right now. And the consequence for poor Opportunity, which is, it was supposed to live 90 days. It's been there 15 years and is still functioning well. But now those solar panels are covered with a layer of Martian dust. So it can't get sunlight. It can't get electricity generated from it. It doesn't have, you'd think it would, but it doesn't have windshield wipers that can clean the dust off.
Right.
And so who knows what its future will be.
And how long does a Martian sandstorm, global sandstorm, go?
Typically, they last a week or two.
That's all?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then it'll be all right, yeah.
Yeah.
What if it gets, what if it, where it is now, ends up under a sand dune? Is that a possibility? In other words, the sand comes through and literally buries this thing.
Oh, well, then that's too bad. Nothing, you know.
Nothing can be done.
No.
It might happen.
I don't know. Well, there's dunes that form, and they do migrate, so I guess it could happen. I don't know if it can happen in this short a time period. I'd feel more comfortable if it were like the other Martian rover on the other side of Mars, Curiosity, which has RTGs. It's powered by nuclear electricity-generating devices, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, because then you don't need the solar panels. You don't have to worry about dust storms.
Right.
Yeah.
But getting telemetry back up into the is there a satellite that beams all the information back?
No, they sends it right
directly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would assume that all the sand would play havoc with the radio waves.
Yeah,
as well. Yes. Now, if I recall correctly, when Opportunity landed, there was another one that also landed, and that's been dark for some time, right?
Yes, Spirit.
Spirit.
Was its name. Yes.
Yeah. And that's been down for
years.
Yeah,
that's been down, yeah.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. And you mentioned before we got on the air that there are plenty of exciting things to see up there.
Oh, it's a very exciting time, yeah. For everybody who's noticed Venus, which is probably everybody because it's that bright thing in the west after sunset.
Yep.
And it's out for hours after sunset. So if you have a window facing roughly the direction of sunset, a little to the right of sunset, you've been staring at it for months. And what's going to happen is it's going to double in brightness between now and the next few months, so that right now it's merely the brightest thing in the sky after the moon at night. But it's going to be bright enough to cast shadows in just coming up in August and September. And meantime, it's in this strange location way to the right of the sunset, to the north, because it's been in the northerly section of the zodiac, the extreme northerly section. So it's to the right of where you normally see it.
Right.
But in the next few months, between now and September, it'll stay at about the same height, but it's going to drift left. It'll go left, 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 left. And so if you have a window facing west, you're going to see it keeping you company, but constantly moving to the left as the summer goes on. So that'll be fun. Keep that in mind when you're watching Venus.
You mentioned that with the sandstorm on Mars, there really isn't a lot of detail to see. And the way I understand it, if you point a telescope at Venus, you will see no detail whatsoever.
No, not now. By the fall, it'll start showing a crescent, like a crescent moon shape. So that's kind of interesting.
But you can't see anything surface-wise.
No, because it doesn't have a surface. It's cloud tops.
Right.
Made of that sulfuric acid droplets. Very, very
Well, reflective. It has a surface. You just can't see it.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Jupiter is also on the move.
Oh, Jupiter's great. So Jupiter, Venus sets maybe 11 o'clock at night, but Jupiter's out all night long. So if it's brighter than any star and it's beyond 11 p.m., you've found Jupiter. Or even before 11, look for the second brightest star-like object. That's Jupiter. And Jupiter's very cool. One, if you've got even binoculars and hold them steady or have those expensive image stabilized binoculars, you can see its moons go around it and change position from night to night. And Jupiter is hovering right over a little star, the brightest star in Libra, named Zuben El Janubi. And this star is very cool because through binoculars, it breaks into two stars.
Huh.
And even though they're about 70 light years away, which is kind of far, the two are so far apart that even binoculars shows it at a beautiful double star, and you see that clearly right below Jupiter in binoculars. So it's a great series, great week, great month to even just have binoculars aimed at the sky.
Astronomer Bob Berman, our guest on Vox Pop today. Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551. Jim in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, you're first.
Yay, Ray. Thank you.
Hi.
Gee, I'm listening to all these interesting things that Mr. Berman's talking about. I heard him utter a dirty word, though. He said the Zodiac?
Yeah, well, we share that with astrology, but
right.
they don't
I'm
own
only
that.
Kidding.
Yes.
Yes, my question is, being a landlubber like I am up here from the Berkshires, when I first went to the ocean and started seeing the tides, I thought it's like, one high tide a day, one low tide a day. And then I find out, oh, my God, there's two of each of those a day. What can you explain? How can you explain to me the planetary effects that cause these two high and two low tides roughly in a 24-hour period?
Well, think of the it's easy to think of the oceans on Earth being mm-hmm. pulled by the moon. The moon doesn't actually pull on our oceans directly. It pulls at the water sideways, horizontally, because there's mm-hmm. no way the moon, being 81 times less heavy than Earth and being a quarter of a million miles away, it can't fight Earth's gravity.
Mm-hmm.
The mm-hmm. ocean is so close to Earth and so far mm-hmm. from the moon that, the moon cannot lift a drop of water, even a hundredth of an inch, up. But what mm-hmm. it can do is slide the water sideways. So picture the ocean. Picture the moon is on the horizon and is pulling mm-hmm. sideways on the water. Well, then there's nothing opposing it. You see, when the moon is trying to pull the water straight up, there's Earth gravity opposing it. But when the moon is at an angle on the horizon, it's pulling sideways. Mm-hmm. There's nothing opposing the sideways motion.
Yeah.
So the water slides towards the moon, and this heaps up and heaps up to produce this 3-foot average tide in the ocean, a bulge mm-hmm. that's in the direction of the moon. When it reaches land, it grows to about 5 feet because of the undersea effects.
But, right.
Okay, so that bulge is easy to understand, a bulge on the side of Earth towards the moon. But there's mm-hmm. an equal bulge, and this is where you get to answer your question, where that second tide, high tide, comes from. There's an equal bulge on the far side of the Earth.
Mm.
There's different ways to visualize what's happening. One of the ways is that the moon is pulling on the oceans more than it's pulling on Earth, but then it's pulling on Earth more than it's pulling on the oceans on the far side.
Ah.
So all three are kind of stretched out. There's other ways to visualize this, but there's an equal bulge on the near side to the moon, on Earth's side closest to the moon, and there's an equal bulge on the far side with low tides in between. Mm. Now picture the Earth rotating under this mm-hmm. mess, and you'll see that you've got to have two highs and two lows in a day.
Well, good question, Jim.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is the number. Jerry in High Falls. Jerry, you're on.
Yes, how are you guys doing? I always listen to NPR as often as I can. What a great station, I must admit.
Thank you.
And my question is, this is going back maybe about 12 years. It was the first week of September. My wife and I were out on lawn chairs watching a beautiful starlit night. And out of nowhere came a bright neon tube light that came down vertically straight and then disappeared by ricocheting and taking off at a 45-degree angle back upward towards the atmosphere. What could that have been?
Wow.
Well, that's nothing that I've ever seen as an astronomer, nothing that I've ever seen as a pilot who does a fair amount of night flying, or at least did for many years. Coming, a red shaft of light coming down, I'd say, well, that's an aurora.
Did he say red? What color was it, Jerry?
A bright, bright neon white blue.
White blue.
Okay.
Well, there, that takes care of the aurora business. Going down and coming back up again, the only thing I can think of in terms of a sky effect is that people sometimes think it's hit the ground when they've actually looked at it at a distant scene. For example, people will see a meteor and they'll say, it was so bright and it landed in my neighbor's yard. But it's in truth, meteors are never seen when they're lower than 50 miles up. So that can be an illusion that it looked like it came down. And the only thing I could think of, and this is a stretch here, is that there was some sort of meteor that went one way and then a meteor that went the other way. But
coincidence.
Other than that, I can't imagine.
That's a good one, Jerry, and we'll have to think about that. We thank you for the call. We'll take a break here. Our guest today is Bob Berman. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back with more of your calls in a moment.
Support comes from the Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, presenting Pete M. Wire's iForest, an immersive sound installation in a wild forest. WildCenter.org for details. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors, serving the Northeast since 2001. StoneSoupConcrete.com and on Facebook. George Heigl Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in buying and selling antique collections for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-7974. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy. Eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY Eyewear, Albany.com. And from the Montessori School of the Berkshires, supporting the natural curiosity of children from toddler through eighth grade. Now enrolling for 2018-2019 school year, BerkshireMontessori.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, and we're joined today by Bob Berman, astronomer deluxe. And we have a few emails that came in, Bob, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one is from, I don't know who it's from, doesn't say. Often we see a rubber mat deflected by the weight of a ball, causing the satellite to move along a curved path around it. This is a question about general relativity. What I don't understand is how this is supposed to be an explanation of gravity. Specifically, where does the force energy come from to make the satellite move toward the massive body? Is space itself an energy source?
The last part first. Space isn't an energy source, except it seems to be pervaded by what we call vacuum energy.
Zero-point energy.
Sometimes called zero-point energy. And that certainly is a lot of energy that's inherent in the vacuum of space. But that's not what's causing the deflection of objects traveling through it, since it's equally everywhere.
Yeah.
And anything that's equally everywhere is not going to do anything to you.
Okay.
So the illustration of that rubber sheet, you put a ball on a rubber sheet, the rubber sheet deflects, has a dimple in it, and then the ball travels in a new path. It's just supposed to show you how space-time curves, and the curvature itself is instigated by any object of mass. In other words, when Einstein was telling us that gravity is really a essentially geometry, the geometry of curving space caused by the nearby presence of massive objects. And that was a better description than the old Newtonian description, although that still didn't really explain what gravity is because it's still a mystery.
And this one came in from Edward in Loudonville. What is it that caused the planet Earth to evolve tectonic plates and jet streams?
Well, that's outside of my field, tectonic plates and jet streams. Tectonic plates, of course, are riding on the hot Earth. The Earth is hot. We used to think it was hot as residual heat from when it was formed. Now we think that the heat is almost entirely caused by radioactive decay, so that uranium with its 4.6 billion year half-life and other objects that are decaying produce the heat. And so that means it's molten under there. And anytime it's molten, you get a top layer that's floating on it. It wouldn't be surprised that given rotation, given gravity, given other torques, that there should be motion on that. And, of course, Alfred Wegener's theory of continental drift, and now we call it plate tectonics.
Sure.
Kind of make sense of all that.
All right.
Jet stream is something else again, and that's simply instigated by the Coriolis effect in conjunction with the fact that at the equator you get more sunlight, more direct sunlight, so heat is always rising from the sunlight. It's then going to move to the right as it tries to go over the globe because of Earth's rotation,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to produce a high winds that are westerly winds at our latitude in the northern hemisphere.
Bob Berman is our guest today, and the number on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551. Chester in Woodstock. Chester, you're on.
Hi, Ray Graff, and hi, Bob Berman. I've been thinking about redshift for actually quite a while, and I'd like to get some feedback on, you know, redshift and what I'm thinking of is things moving very far away from us. The light is shifted toward the red, so we know that they are accelerating away from us, and that's been a big mystery. So is it possible that material that's closer to us is collapsing at an accelerated rate? So maybe that's causing the thing. Rather than distant objects accelerating, maybe we are accelerating into a collapse. So maybe you can comment for me on that.
Well, a collapse per se wouldn't cause a redshift. What would cause it, if it weren't a recessional redshift, would be gravity. And there were some astrophysicists led by Halton Arp, especially in the 1980s going into the early 1990s,
mm-hmm.
who was advocating that the redshifts we see, many of them are not caused by recessional speeds, but caused instead by places of gravity. And he'd point out certain anomalies. There's a quintet of galaxies in Pegasus called Stefan's Quintet, where one galaxy has a very different redshift than all the others, and yet they seem linked together. So he said, see, they're at the same distance. They ought to show the same redshift, but one of them doesn't. So,
right.
But it turned out that better telescopes, namely Hubble, resolved that to find that one anomalous redshift in Stefan's Quintet was actually a foreground object.
Ah.
And they were not connected after all. And so these days, nobody or virtually nobody feels that cosmological redshifts anyway are caused by things with tremendous gravity. That said, you still get redshifts caused by very strong gravitational fields. Every white dwarf, certainly every neutron star like the one in the heart of the Crab Nebula, has such strong gravity that the light that we see is redshift just because of gravitational effects.
So from my understanding, you're saying that there's inconsistent redshift on objects that we know to be at equal distance from us? Is that what you're saying?
No. Well, we used to think there might be. As I said, that was an argument made for that some, if not most, objects we thought were at cosmological distance are actually just experiencing, we're seeing gravitational redshifts, but that has been disproven
because we
now
have better telescopes.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to have to listen to a podcast of this and go over what you just said.
Okay.
I thank you for the answer.
My
Take
pleasure.
Care, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chester. We appreciate the call. 800-348-2551, our number. Bob Berman is our guest, and Paul in New Paltz is next.
Hello, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, what was the origin of the lunar calendar?
Uh-huh.
Well, there are many lunar calendars. Almost all early cultures, the Hebrews, the Mayans, had lunar calendars, and in many cultures they were the predominant calendar rather mm-hmm. than a solar calendar. And the reason for that is obvious. The moon is clear at night. Its cycles recur at very even rates. The moon goes around us at an unvarying rate mm-hmm. at once every 27.32166 days. And then the cycle of phases, which is 29 and a half days, it cries out for a calendar because any regularly occurring occurrence that can be easily seen in particular, that's just saying, hey, make me a calendar, because we can base our lives around this regularly recurring event. Mm-hmm. So the fact of the moon's phases was the easiest to see. Other cultures, like the Mayans, also used Venus, which has various cycles in its appearances and disappearances.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. A lot of satisfied customers here on the program this early, Bob. Well, I'm sure we'll put a stop to that soon enough. Let's go to Mike in Hudson. Mike, you're on.
Hi there, guys. I have a question. I've tried for a long time to find an answer for this on the internet, but I can't quite find an answer. What I'd like to know is if all the stars that are out there are producing basically a continuous sphere of energy, heat and light and everything along the spectrum, and they're all continuously producing this. How is that accounted for in astronomy, as all that energy has been doing this for billions of years and is just sort of traveling through space? Shouldn't the empty space that's there be filling more and more with energy from the electromagnetic spectrum from all the stars that are putting it out there?
Well, it would if empty space could absorb the energy, let's say, but it doesn't because it's not actually empty because space is filled with fields, magnetic fields, electrical fields. We were just talking about vacuum energy. There's neutrinos that flood through the universe. There's all sorts of things that are still there in empty space, but none of that absorbs electromagnetic energy, meaning light. Enough. So light really continues undisturbed once it's created in the core of a star. And most of the star does not create the energy. Like in our sun, there's a little tiny ball in the very center of the sun. It's only about 1/200th the volume of the sun. It's a little tiny ball.
Yeah.
And that makes all the energy. In the sun's case, it's equal to 96 billion 1 megaton H-bombs per second.
Wow.
And the sun that we see that seems to be shining, you know, I mean, sometimes through a bit of a thin cloud, you can actually see the sun's size, see its disk. But that's just where the light is escaping. The sun isn't creating that power that we see. We're just seeing the very narrow, I should say thin shellac called the photosphere, where the sun is leaving, is letting the energy leave itself.
Yeah.
But it comes from within, and that's the case with all stars. And once it's created, there's nothing in space that will absorb it. So we get whatever there is, it could travel forever. There's no reason why it should ever be lost. I mean, a long time ago, Paul Dirac in the 1930s postulated that maybe light gets tired. Maybe light speed can slow down over time. Maybe energy can lose, you know, gets tired after billions of years of traveling. But we've seen no evidence that's true.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. Cataclysm, not out yet, though, right? The new book?
No, I don't even know what the date is. Yes,
but it's done. It's ready.
The publisher is still going through it. I just learned that my very favorite fact checker will be doing this book just like she did my last two.
Why is she your favorite?
Oh, because she's so good. Ray, a few books ago in Zoom, I wrote in one chapter that in a baseball stadium where the batter faces north, like Yankee Stadium, and I chose Yankee Stadium because I used Google Earth to zoom in on it, the batter faces north. I said that a ball that would have been a home run occasionally will be a foul ball because of the Coriolis effect. The ball will curve to the right and hit the foul post or go to the right of the right field foul post and just be an out instead of a home run in stadiums like Yankee Stadium. Well, she, this fact checker at Little Brown, my publisher, wrote me back and said, no, Yankee Stadium, the batters don't face north. You better choose Wrigley Field instead. I'm going, but I checked on Google Earth. Well, it turned out Yankee Stadium was undergoing a major renovation.
Right.
And she caught that and got the latest direction that the batters actually do face, and she caught that error. Who would catch that?
That's very cool. Well, she's good. And so your book will be out sometime in the fall, I assume.
Yep. Subtitle is, Cataclysms. I always try to have
You have a long subtitle. It's one of your trademarks.
It's the Supernovae, Exploding Galaxies, and Earthly Mayhem that Shakes Our Universe.
All right. I'll just call it Cataclysm. Bob Berman is our guest, and let's go back to the phones. Aaron in Pelham, Massachusetts. Aaron, you're on.
Oh, hi. Enjoy the program.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could talk about the total solar eclipse that's happening, the next ones.
The next ones.
Well, there's not a next month. It's a partial eclipse. It's not a total solar eclipse. The next total eclipse will be next year in South America.
Right.
Off the town of La Serena. And then the year after, in 2020, we're going to have another one down there in Chile, this time in the Patagonia region.
Uh-huh.
And then the year after, on December 4th, 2021, we'll have one in Antarctica. 2022, there are none. 2023, it'll be just the leftmost little town in Australia and little parts of those Indonesian-type islands that are just north of Australia. And then comes the big one, April 8th, 2024, when we're going to have the nearest total eclipse to Albany that we've had in the last century.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have one that'll be total over Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Burlington, Vermont.
Right.
And so just our own neighborhood totality. That's coming up in 2024.
Well, there you go, Aaron.
Excellent. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number here, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. And Steve in Pinebush is next. Steve.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling about that second caller who saw this vertical light phenomena at night a while back. I live in Pine Bush, and my first reaction was a Husky.
Hang on. You got to speak closer to the phone, or if you're on a cell phone, move around a little bit. Go ahead, Steve.
So I'm calling about the second caller who saw this vertical light phenomenon.
Yeah, we got that, yeah.
I live in Pine Bush, and I thought it had to be a UFO because Pine Bush is the UFO capital of New York.
Uh-huh.
But I also recognized that it could be the phenomena called Steve, which is a new type of aurora that was identified recently.
You've
right, but a Steve wouldn't go make a vertical motion down and then back up again. Also, it wouldn't be bluish.
Vertical motion.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be bluish white, the color he reported.
What color is Steve?
Greenish.
Greenish?
Steve tends to be purple towards green, but I thought that the color of the aurora varies based on the intensity of the solar flare that caused it.
The color really varies more towards what we can see. For example, some auroras produce very nice reds, but we don't see a trace of them because the human eye is so insensitive to red at 6,400 angstroms, which is where the auroral color is. We're very sensitive at 5577 angstroms, which is where the aurora puts out most of its light. That's in the green part of the spectrum. So that's what really determines whether we see colors or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Steve.
So it probably was a UFO then.
Uh-huh. Yeah, probably.
Well, it's unidentified. Yep. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551.
I didn't know Pine Bush was the UFO capital.
Yeah, it has been for some time. That's what they call themselves, some of them who live in Pine behind Bush. And they have, you know, UFO conferences there from time to time. It's, I gather there's some business interest involved. Let's go back to the phones here and get another one in before the next break. We'll go to Ryan in Clifton Park. Ryan.
Hi. I just had a quick one about the tides. I got thinking about it. Does the atmosphere also have a tide like the ocean does?
Yes, it does. It does. There's an atmospheric tide. There's also a solid ground tide. And I mention that because I happen to know what it is. That's an 8-inch, some say 12-inch tide. In other words, where the entire Earth widens and then narrows again, mm-hmm. depending on the position of the moon. That's not much. It just shows how well-built our planet is to only suffer a one-foot deformation caused by the moon. But the ocean also has a response to the moon.
What about
the
molten interior
of the Earth?
Would that have a tide?
I don't know.
Okay. Could you find out? Can you go down and find out for us?
All right,
Ryan, you want to follow up?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
Great question. Thank you very much. Bob Berman is our guest. Always fun to have Bob on these airwaves. 800-348-2551, the number. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Support comes from Blue Sky Bicycles, Saratoga Springs, New York, now offering pedal-assist electric bikes to the Capital Region, a new way to enjoy the outdoors. Test rides available, blueskybicycles.com. Vintage 20 Wine and Spirits, Duanesburg, offering Father's Day spirits such as whiskey, scotch, and bourbon. Open 7 days a week, providing home delivery services. Vintage20wine.com. Round Lake Auditorium announcing their summer season of music, art, and theater performances, located in the historic village of Round Lake. RoundLakeAuditorium.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years, QFCC.com. Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, practicing aesthetic plastic surgery, working to help people improve their appearance and well-being. A surgeon's hands, a woman's touch, CAPEK, PlasticSurgery.com. And from Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors. Serving the Northeast since 2001, StoneSoupConcrete.com and on Facebook.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Vox Pop is the show. Bob Berman is the guest, and the number is 800-348-2551. Brenda in Pine Plains. Hello, Brenda. Hello. Hello, Brenda. Hello, Brenda. Oh, Brenda. Call us back, all right? Let's go to Sheridan Woodstock. What is going on? What is going on? But you got to turn your radio down, man. Hi, caramba. All right, we'll just take a moment here and we'll straighten it out. A couple of ground rules. Number one, I know that sometimes you wait for a while to be on the phone because a lot of people call. So if you're going to wait, be ready for the call if you could. And then the other thing is, don't crank the radio too loudly, because then, although we enjoy the sound of our own voices, we have headphones and we can hear them anyway. But when we hear them coming back, it's a little disconcerting. So do me a favor, turn your radio down, and then be ready for us to say hello. Now, I see Brenda and Sherrod are calling back. So in a minute here, while we're waiting for our call screener to go through it, Bob, tell us about what Cataclysms is all about.
It's about the dramatic stuff that have happened across the universe on Earth.
So not just on Earth. All around the whole universe.
Around the whole universe. We talked about exploding stars and things that were even more violent than that. And then we go to the Earth for about half the book and talk about things like even nuclear weapons and plagues. So
it's an uplifting, feel-good book.
It's dramatic, and I've learned a lot in it. Uh, I, I did not know that once a ship with the plague reached port and the first rats that were infected left the ship, that it was a reliable 23 days before the first people would come down with the plague. It was like a clock. It was so reliable.
And how did they know? How did they prove
because
this?
That's the time it took the rats on shore to get infected for them, for the ticks, not ticks, fleas on board those rats to bite the first people and for the people to then go through the incubation period and actually get the plague. So it was like wherever the ships that were carrying plague docked, 23 days later, people started getting sick. And then it was about a week-long illness that some survived, but it was always a fight for life. That was a tough one.
It's a happy book that you've written.
It was fascinating. I really thought it was fascinating.
You ready to go back to the phones?
Yeah.
Now that we're in a good mood talking about the plague, let's go to Dell, who's in the car. Dell, you're on.
Yes, how are you guys? Thanks for putting me through. Sure. My question is, well, first let me tell you, I've been like fascinated by astronomy as young as 5 years old. I got my first telescope when I was around 8. And just looking up, it's always intrigued me, and you know, it stayed with me my whole life. And like, I've studied it, I've read about it as much as I can. I ain't gonna say I went to college or anything for it, but my question is, what's I'm sorry, I forgot your name, Mr.
Berman.
Yeah, please. What's your opinion on the Mayans being so precise with their astronomy? Like, because even with all my learnings and all the technology we have today and my telescope, like I told you, like, I can't even fathom like being able to put this together like the way
all
they
right.
did.
That's a good question.
And a two part question. Not just them, the coincidence with the Egyptians doing it the same way, almost as if not even more precise. Like, is there any type? Like, what do you think about it?
All right, Bob. How did the ancients get so precise with their astronomy?
Well, I could be flip and say they didn't have much to do at night except watch the sky. The sky was a lot clearer then. Mm-hmm. They didn't have light pollution, and these things were very obvious. So cultures who cared about the sky and thought of it as pertaining to their own lives, and not all of them did. For example, the Hebrews did not watch the sky. They did not make predictions. They did not create calendars, possibly because they didn't see the sky as influencing their lives almost in an astrological way. But other cultures that did, like the Mayans, since the caller brought up the Mayans, could not help but note that these things recur, that the moon very exactly get the first occurrence of that beautiful hair-thin crescent waxing moon every month when you first see it. The next time would be 29 and a half days later.
Right.
And so naturally, we're going to make a calendar based on that 29 and a half day lunar occurrence. They noted that Venus has this 224 day cycle and another cycle of 8 years where it does the same behavior in the sky. And so they had Venus calendars as well. The more sophisticated ones made solar calendars, Stonehenge and other monuments.
I thought that was a lunar calendar.
Stonehenge was good for both.
Really?
Yeah, because it was a line. You could watch things rising and setting along either way. But it was only the sun that came back to precise spots, because the moon has a 5-degree tilt from the plane of the ecliptic.
Yeah.
So the sun tracks it exactly. The moon has these vagaries that you need to be really sophisticated to keep track of. And so
they look for it.
Yeah. What'd you say, Del?
You think it was just that simple? Just like me, they just got intrigued by it and started
track. I think so, and they certainly took it seriously enough. As the Mayans, as we know, threw people off the tops of their pyramids on some occasions.
They threw people off the top?
Well, they said it was called sacrifices, but it's hard to believe that these people said, hey, me, choose me.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Is that a new happy new book too, Bob? Thanks for the call, Dell. Let's go to now. We'll go to Sherrod in Woodstock. Hi, Sherrod. You're back.
Say, I was wondering about the wobble stone and if there's any relationship to the automobile races on oval tracks going counterclockwise.
Now, when you say wobblestone, what's that?
That's an elliptical stone about the size of a big finger that's got two elliptical curves. You spin it clockwise, and it goes unstable. You spin it counterclockwise, and it continues spinning.
For how long?
Depends on how fast you spin it. I'll bring a wobble stone by someday. It's
wow.
Amazing.
That sounds pretty cool.
Have you ever seen that?
No,
right?
No.
No, I've never heard of that either. So having never heard of that.
Double elliptical. I've got one piece of plastic. It's got a double elliptical curve. You spin it clockwise, and it goes wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. But you spin it counterclockwise, and it just keeps spinning like a top.
Neato.
That's interesting. I have an Euler disc at home. Named after the mathematician Euler, that when put on a very, very smooth glass-like parabolic surface, you give it a spin, and it'll spin for maybe 3 full minutes before it'll settle down and stop spinning. But the direction of spin is immaterial. So I'm not familiar with the object you're talking about, I don't think I can answer a question about it.
Sorry about that.
I keep it in my briefcase because I win bets at beer at bars.
Yeah.
Good for you, man. That's brilliant. Thank you for the call. And let's go over to Brenda in Pine Plains. Brenda, you're on now.
Oh, good. Okay. I just wanted, the other day you had one of these short, where you just say a few lines, and you spoke about sunspots on the sun, and I was wondering if you could talk more about that. That sounded really intriguing.
Oh, maybe you're referring to
Strange Universe. Yeah, every Sunday we have this 3 minutes.
Oh, I guess so. It was a very brief, and I only caught part of it. And you spoke about how the canals in Venice froze a couple of hundred years ago.
Oh, yes, because
there were no sunspots on the sun, and that this is happening now. And I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, there's roughly as you probably have heard, an 11-year sunspot cycle where the sun has more storms, which show themselves as black spots, and then fewer storms. And it's an irregular cycle, but it averages 11 years. But a strange thing happened from 1645 to 1715 during that one human lifetime we now call the Maunder Minimum.
Yes.
The sun stopped having this 11-year sunspot cycle, and the sun was blank from spots for a whole human lifetime. And during that time, the Earth got colder. As I said, the canals on Venice froze. There were great hardship. The fishing colonies in Greenland and Iceland were abandoned. The colonies in America at that time suffered their worst winters. It was a time of terrible hardship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody knows why the sunspot cycle should stop. But the recent strange behavior of the sun,
yes,
where cycle number 24, which is just finishing up now.
Not a biggie.
No, it's been the smallest cycle that we've seen since probably around the year 1800. And it was preceded by a strange minimum at the end of cycle number 23 before that, has led some solar experts to wonder, maybe we're on the cusp of another Maunder Minimum. In any case, the lack of sunspots right now is certainly having a cooling effect on the planet, which is mitigating global warming. In other words, the sun is coming to our rescue a little bit right now. We don't know how long.
We had such a cold winter, maybe, you know, that a lot of snow and.
Yeah, it wasn't much fun, was it, Brenda?
Yeah, so we don't know what will happen. Nobody knows for sure if this is the start of a longer period of strange solar activity,
right,
which seems to be the consensus now among solar experts, or whether this was just a kind of a one or two cycle phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and see.
One thing we know about experts is they're often wrong, even when they agree. So we'll see. We'll find out. Bob Berman is our guest. 800. Bob never wrong, though. 800-348-2551, the number. Dave in Scotia. Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Quick question. Is everything that we see visible at night, all those stars, are they all within our galaxy? Are they all in the Milky Way?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And the answer is yes. The only spot that the naked eye could see that's not in our galaxy is the next spiral galaxy, Andromeda, best seen in the fall. So in September, October nights, there's one little tiny dim patch, elliptical patch, and that's the next galaxy. But everything that looks like a star, everything that's a dot of light, is definitely a star in just our own galaxy. And not only in our galaxy, but there are the nearer stars in our galaxy. Yeah. Typically, the typical naked eye star that you see is 200 light years away. The farthest ones that you'll see naked eye are maybe 3,000 light years away.
That's a long way.
And our galaxy goes on for 100,000 light years. So not only are they in our galaxy, but they're the nearer stars in our own galaxy.
Wow. Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Dave. And how is the mapping of the Milky Way coming? Have they fully mapped it?
Well, I don't know if it'll ever be fully mapped because you're talking about 400 billion stars. But every time you get another sky survey that goes down dimmer, like one goes to 20th magnitude, and now somebody will decide, okay, we're going to use this bigger telescope and go down to the 22nd magnitude, you always get a geometrically greater number of stars because there are more dimmer things than brighter things
right.
throughout the cosmos.
Do you think that the Milky Way is more or less an average galaxy?
It's a little bigger than average.
Yeah.
The average ones, like if you're in the southern hemisphere, you can see the Magellanic Clouds, our companion galaxies. They're dwarf, irregular galaxies. They don't really have a spiral shape, and they're smaller than ours. So those are more typical in the universe. They might have just a few billion stars as opposed to 400 billion that we have.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Still a few minutes left in this edition of Bob Berman's Vox Pop. Let's go to Judy in Woodstock. Judy.
Hey, I want to take a little issue with Bob's description of the Jewish calendar as not being based on the sky because it's a lunar calendar and there are some solar elements to it, which is to say, for example, Hanukkah comes at the dark of the moon nearest to the winter solstice.
Did you tune in late to our show? Because I started the show off by mentioning the Hebrew calendar as being a lunar calendar. Maybe you missed that.
I tuned in late. Yes.
Yeah. No, we okay. already we talked about the far from not mentioning the Hebrew calendar as being lunar based. We emphasized that actually early in the show, so you just missed that.
Okay.
Thanks, Judy.
Very good. Thanks.
Have a good one. Over to Phil. Phil in Orange, Massachusetts. Phil, you're on with Bob Berman.
Good afternoon. My question is about Einstein's, what he called his greatest blunder by developing a cosmological constant because he didn't know there was a red shift. So nowadays, I read that you're going to use the cosmological constant for some other application. What is that?
First of all, what was the cosmological constant? Give us a rough idea of what he was doing.
Well, back then it was believed that the universe was neither expanding nor shrinking, that it was
static,
the same size. And Einstein's general relativity only worked if the universe were changing.
Ah.
And so because it didn't jibe with what was believed to be true, he added a kind of fudge number, just a single number that he called the cosmological constant, so that it would work in a static universe.
Mm-hmm.
Later, he called that his greatest blunder because
he was right all along.
Exactly. When Edwin Hubble, using the 100-inch Hooker telescope in California, discovered that the universe was actually expanding and announced that in 1930, Einstein realized that he would have predicted that expansion if only he had stuck to his guns and hadn't put in this cosmological constant. Now, that having been said, we found out in 1998, to our surprise, that the universe's expansion is increasing its rate of expansion due to mysterious causes that we now call dark energy. And so we now reinsert the cosmological constant and say, well, the cosmological constant must be the thing that's causing the universe to increase its rate of expansion. And so even though Einstein didn't intend it to be used that way, it could be, if the cosmological constant is dark energy, and this is causing the universe to blow up and expand faster and faster, that's the resurrection of Einstein's cosmological constant.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. We appreciate the call. All right, Bob Berman, what's next for you?
Well, I'll be going to Minneapolis in a couple of weeks to do the Alcon convention. I'll be the keynote.
Oh, great.
There.
What's your presentation likely to discuss?
I gave them three topics, and they chose one that no astronomical body has chosen in years. I'm looking forward to it, which is how to learn from Hollywood and give the best possible outdoor under the sky show. With your backyard telescope or whatever equipment you have.
Well, that'll be fun. Yeah. And you've done this for years.
Yeah, but I haven't done this particular talk in some years, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, Bob Berman, always a great pleasure to have you on the program. And support comes from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic at Watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Mass Match, for over 16 years, a locally owned dating and matchmaking service, connecting singles through private matchmaking in Western Massachusetts and beyond. MassMatch.com. Colby Attorney Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939. ColbyService.com. Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe or world, and from local artisans, hand-picked selection of wines, single malts, and small batch bourbons, grapesandgrainswine.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thank you for the calls and for keeping your radio turned off when you were on the phone. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Deb Malik. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday, and we'll explore world cuisine with Umana Restaurant and Wine Bar in Albany. Right now, stand by for news.